you're always like the last one to know that you're more than friends. And I remember she turned to us at some point after we had said something sort of adorable and said, when are you two just going to do it? And Kristen, I remember, said, we can't. It would be too good. And I think that's the moment I actually fell for her. We leave whenever we want after the kid goes to bed, and we just hand the baby monitor to anyone who's around, like 100% success rate in doing that. We don't have to hire a babysitter. We don't have to coordinate. Living within baby monitor distance, that's what we call it, is like one of the biggest life hacks.
If one person does it, it feels unfair, but if both of us do it, it's like a benefit.
It's like those poly relationships with only one person takes advantage of the poly are like doomed. We give our fights names so we can like name them, like, oh, Fred's in the room now.
I think that's maybe one of our values, is we try different things. So like, we're like, we have tried scheduled sex. We have decided, sometimes we do it, sometimes we don't. What? Oh. It's fine. He literally asked.
Kristen, Phil, welcome to Modern Relationships.
We've been in one for a while, so we're here. We're ready.
So you guys have been in a dream couple ever since the beginning. You know, you're best friends. You're both incredibly beautiful, both very successful, have lovely friends, run a co-living community together. What do you guys think that you do differently than other couples? Or what do you think that you've learned that other people can learn from, whether it's on the partner selection side or the just making the relationships great side that our audience can learn from?
We just start with the easy question. Maybe we start with partner selection. I think Phil and I were friends for a couple of years before we got together. And I think that is a novel concept in some worlds, because the transition to people seems hard. And I think for us, one, alcohol was obviously involved, but it really is.
In making the final transition.
In making the final transition, yeah.
I think it was building up to that.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay, cool. But I think you're sourcing with a friend, somebody that you really like and admire. And that is kind of core to a relationship, is I really admire Phil. I ask him for his opinion on everything from personal to work, and there's like deep admiration there. And that's like sometimes the core of a friendship. And so I think for us, we were building on kind of a deep admiration, just wanting to be around each other. It grew into this romantic thing that now is the foundation of, you know, really healthy and I think fun relationship.
Yeah. I've noticed that like a decent portion of the best relationships I know often started as a friendship and went a very long time as a friendship. And they didn't think themselves as more than friends, but all their friends knew they were more than friends. Like, they're almost like, you're always like the last one to know that you're more than friends. And I remember with like Kristen and I, we were walking down the street back before we were together with another mutual friend. And she turned to us at some point after we had said something sort of adorable and said, when are you two just going to do it? And it was a humiliating moment. I just went totally red. And Kristen, I remember, said, we can't. It would be too good. And I think that's the moment I actually fell for her.
Nice. And then yeah, like, consider, you know, we're right.
Usually what happens is one person likes the other, but, there's some friend zoning that happens. I mean, usually when, you know, people are friends, is because they're not attracted, right? So I guess, and they're scared to ruin the friendship in some way. So did the attraction grow over time? Like, you know, they result in the best relationships sometimes, but also they also result in ruined friendships. So I guess, how do you navigate that? And how do you think about sort of, it's one thing to be friends for a few months, another thing to be friends for 2 years. And that's like a bit of time where you're like, okay, I'm not pursuing this person.
Yeah. I don't know, because these are like back rationalizations. So I'd say the way that I rationalize it is, I think when I was dating and we were like actively dating, you know, at the same time. And so I think I had this vision of the person that I was looking for or supposed to be with. And it was kind of a narrow band. And I don't think like Phil fit into that specific vision of the person. And so I don't think like my eyes were as like open to it.
And what was that vision? Was it like 6'5"? Like,
yeah,
not bald. Was that the vision?
No, I think I had like the extrovert at the party, the person who's like, you know, like kind of like I'm very extroverted in many ways, and someone who was like me. And so that's who I was looking for. And I think I just wasn't as aware of like, well, actually the person I really want to spend time with is this person right in front of me.
Yeah. That's interesting. And Phil, how did it develop for you?
You know, I, looking back, and again, back rationalization, but I should have known, like when I met Kristen, it was actually at a job interview. I was interviewing for a job with her, and I was living in London at the time. I wasn't even in San Francisco. And I was so compelled by her that I think she actually got me. She was like the person that got me to move to San Francisco, I now realize. Because I was like, if people like that are there, I want to be there. And I remember I had such a strong reaction to her that I like wrote another friend about her. I'm like, I met this woman in this. And still, I didn't think about her as like more than a friend, right? Which is like crazy looking back. But clearly was actually a spark very early on. Like Kristen said, I think there's like a mental band of who you date that you create in your head. And if somebody falls outside that band for whatever reason, it just doesn't compute until it computes one day.
And so the lessons that we're taking away here on partner selection, one, you know, look more at friends, you know, two, look more in your friend network already, two.
Oh, like, hang out with a friend.
Yeah, exactly.
Go home and do that today. That's our recommendation.
Yeah, if you're listening to this, you know, just leave the podcast right now. Or, you know, you said listen to who your friends think you should date, because friends have good insight about you. And then also what I heard from you, Kristen, is sort of this idea of like, look at long-term traits rather than, or be more open-minded as to what you're attracted to or what you care about.
Yeah. I think that's a very nice one for folks to consider. Like, I think we usually, especially in like a sort of mating, we go to the people who are like very closely within our band. But I think like a sort of mating basically says we're actually just very narrow in our preferences, and actually even more than looks, we should just kind of expand what we're open to. And this would expand the dating pool and likely help kind of find the person.
Yeah. What mistakes do you see friends and other people make around partner selection, or that you've made in the past before each other, that we haven't yet discussed?
I have never seen an example of a situation where everyone's close friends are not excited about the relationship and it turns out to be a good relationship. So I think like you go and you ask your friends, what do you think about this person? And your friends, they're probably not gonna tell you the truth. Like, but you can tell from their faces if they're either really excited about the person you're dating or anything else. And if it's anything else, it's probably actually a really negative signal. I think friends often actually have you pegged better than you do. And you should really use them as a resource.
Yeah. I would say probably staying in relationships too long. I think the status quo is kind of the main thing that we're fighting in life, and it's very easy to feel comfortable with somebody in that, you know, there's an opportunity cost to that. And we just don't see the other people that you're missing out on as the opportunity cost because you're with the person right now. And so I think thinking about kind of the opportunity cost of the people that you could be with, not in like a always evaluating grass is greener, but in the moment where you're deciding, is this person the right one for me? Looking at the status quo is maybe not your friend in these situations.
Yeah. And I think one thing I've heard you say, Kristen, is like, be realistic as to, you know, what your sort of options are based on where you're at in life and what's know the market. Yeah.
I think that's right.
This question's not making me look good, by the way.
Not right. No, I married up.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm totally married up.
Let's frame this in a way that makes me look awesome on the podcast.
Okay. Yeah. I think one major thing is like, I actually think why sourcing people as friends is so important is like people, and this is kind of, I'm a behavioral scientist, and so I do believe in behavior change, but many times those core personality traits don't change. And so like when we source each other's friends, like I knew what I was getting, like he's not going to all of a sudden change into somebody who picks his clothes up off the floor. Like it's not going to happen. but you will still be funny always. And so, but I think that's maybe a key mistake that folks make is thinking that people will fundamentally change those core kind of traits. And in general, you're signing up for that person. Just like we have flaws, they have flaws. And it's very easy to be optimistic about the other person and not be as optimistic about yourself.
And when you started dating, did you already have the shared values around wanting to live in community? Did you already have kind of a shared vision for your life?
I think we had the seeds of it. And so the sort of story was like, you know, Chris and I were friends and then we started dating. We happened to be living a block from each other. And we started hanging out at this place called the Embassy, which I think has actually had a lot of influence on a lot in San Francisco, actually, which is sort of this like cool community in this big mansion in the Lower Haight. And, you know, I'd always been someone that thought, you know, hey, I'm going to meet a partner. We're going to go get a one bedroom apartment out in the sunset or something together. And that's what you do when you meet a partner. And I think it was like seeing the alternative, which is seeing this like really cool community with smart, ambitious people all living together and what that brought. And then Kristen, of course, being a professional behavioral scientist, reinforcing this idea with like all the studies that show that proximity to people is actually one of the most important factors in your happiness. That like when it came time to have the like, let's move in together conversation, we didn't go for the one bedroom in the sunset. We were like, let's do an experiment. Let's get a 9-bedroom house in Hayes Valley, invite a bunch of people we think are interesting and see how that goes. And so that sort of started as an experiment. And this was a house called RGB, which is still in existence. I think how many years later? 9 years later. I think little did we know this is sort of the way we'd always live. And so like at this point, you know, I think we're always going to live in various forms of community, and the form factor is going to change over time. And so we're at our second, getting to like our third iteration of this now.
Yeah. And I think a value that we did source each other on was likelihood to do projects. So I think one thing that makes our relationship different is that we do projecting together, and these projects could be kind of side hobbies, but a lot of this is like building community and real estate. And so kind of having that shared energy to do something extra in life, I think was an attraction for us initially. And then it manifested in these like multiple houses, but like we kind of sourced each other on people who are likelihood to do fun life design stuff.
One of the sort of experiments you did early on was this Tinder group date where you hosted a party and invited a bunch of people that you had individually matched with to that party even before you guys were together.
Yeah. We did that. I think that later became like a startup. What was it called? This was before
Grouper,
that existed.
Grouper or whatever. Grouper,
yeah. We did DIY Grouper.
This was just like us kind of playing around, being like, what would be fun? One time we also, I don't know if this was before or after we were dating, took over a bar and had like a treatment and a control. Like treatment was upstairs, control was downstairs. And we both designed the experiment. We both surveyed people. And it was like this enjoyable side project.
Yeah, we had a couple ideas of how you make bars actually places that you would want to meet people. I mean, Chris and I were like interested in how people socialize just as a thing to study. And so we the bottom floor was the control floor, the top floor was the test floor, and we would sort people as they came in and say you have to go upstairs or downstairs when they came into the bar, like random strangers. And the test floor had like various interventions we'd run on the people, and then we surveyed them on the way out to see if the intervention worked and they actually talked to more people at the bar. It turns out people going out of a bar don't like to say exit surveys. So I think we learned there was some operational learning there more than
the core maybe actionable insight for folks is to think about what projects you can do with your partner. I think this actually gives us a third object to focus on. Like we're collaborating on something that's bigger than ourselves. We're having fun together.
Yeah.
We're entertaining ourselves. We're creating memories.
It makes you fight about the clothes on the floor less.
Totally. Yeah. I remember those.
Do you think more people should be doing sort of this co-living even as adults and even as adults with kids? What do people not fully appreciate either about the upsides, or what do they overestimate about the downsides?
Yeah. So, I mean, the answer is yes. This is our personality at this point. So we're going to say yes, but I think people wildly do over, they focus on these like small downsides and they fail to appreciate the enormous upsides that like I think very much compensate for those. And you know, so I'll sort of like sketch what life looks like us for now. So we live in a sort of, we call it a friend compound in Oakland. We have, there's 10 homes. And then we have a building, which is just a shared building between us. So it's sort of like the like clubhouse of the compound of 10 homes. And there's now 20 grownups living there and 5, soon to be 7 kids coming. And I think our life as parents, like relative to some of our friends, is just like so much easier. So we leave whenever we want after the kid goes to bed, and we just hand the baby monitor to anyone who's around, like 100% success rate in doing that, which means we don't have to hire a babysitter. We don't have to coordinate. So I think like living within baby monitor distance, that's what we call it, is like one of the biggest life hacks when you have young kids that go to sleep at 7, because you go from someone who can't leave your house after 7 to someone who can leave your house every single night whenever you want after 7 with no planning or coordination. And that's just a huge unlock. All it takes is living within a baby monitor range of a couple friends, and you can have that. I think the other one is we don't cook. So we have 20 people. There's a cooking rotation. We're not in it. We're terrible cooks. We do dishes, but it's like I haven't thought about groceries or cooking a meal in a long time.
And I think some of this is like perceptually, it seems like living near friends or living in community feels harder. And I think that's because people are focused on some of the maybe new overhead, but life has a lot of overhead. Like life is just hard. And so what living by or near friends does is take away some of the overhead, like cooking or childcare, that actually like is really big in normal life. I would say the other two benefits of living in community. One is, you know, Eli Finkel wrote a book called All or Nothing Marriage, which basically suggests that, like, you know, Phil and I were to only rely on each other for everything, work problems, personal problems, that this is giving kind of too much to the other person, and that actually we should diversify.
Putting too much on that person.
To the other person. And so what community does is that naturally, like, I'm going to get home and talk to somebody else about an annoying thing that happened today. Phil doesn't have to listen. He doesn't every day have to ask me how my day was. Although I do love it when you do. So by living with or around other people, you kind of get that level of diversification that is healthy. The second thing is probably something we call a social desirability effect, which is this idea that you act better in front of other people. So Phil and I are living in public. We are not really in public, but like, you know, we're hanging out with
We have our own house.
We have our own house, our own kitchen, 3 bedrooms. We're good. Yeah. But you know, we're like within a community, we're observed more. People see us behaving as a couple. And we're just nicer to each other. We just like are better people. We're like, and I see Phil being funny with other people and being smart. And I'm like, wow, that's like, he's amazing. So I see him in his best versus I think a lot of times in long-term relationships, it's very easy to kind of show your worst or your lower points to the other person because you're so comfortable with them. They're not performing at all. So I think living around people helps us be better people.
Forcing the perform is actually good. Yeah. Like you sort of want to be your raw bare metal cell all the time.
And so what's a downside for people to just be, you know, eyes open about sort of the trade-offs of this? Is it just, hey, you might have to interact with people you don't like, you might just have less alone time, or, you know, what's sort of the realistic trade-off?
Yeah, there's more coordination that has to happen. Like not everything is a considered decision you 100% control. Like other people have a stake in your decisions and you have to negotiate that with them. Yeah, and I think also the time. So when you have a ton of your best friends living within 100 feet of you, that they are a gravity well that I think sucks you in. And it can be harder to go read a book alone because all your friends are next door. It's like, you want to hang out with them. It's like very easy and natural. So I think actually like finding time for ourselves can be hard, not because it's demanding of you, but just because you sort of need to like force yourself out of it sometimes. I got anything of that.
I think those are two fair downsides.
Let's go back to the sort of converting friends / farming from within sourcing strategy that you guys pioneered. You know, one of the trade-offs, people are certainly concerned about, you know, ruining the friendship, et cetera, or just feeling, you know, rejected, or kind of once you open that seal, it's hard to, you know, hard to pretend it wasn't open perhaps. But I think there's a broader concern people have, which is like, hey, I'm not attracted to them. Like if I was that I would have done something by now, or they're like a sibling or something. And I've heard you say, Kristen, lean into that. Incest, it's hot. And maybe you can flesh that out.
Great title of my next book. Thank you.
How do you think about attraction? And maybe men and women are different here, but how do you think about that?
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, we had to change some of our norms. So like we had to learn to greet each other in a much more non-friendly way. You know, like we did have to learn how to change like these small behaviors. I think for women specifically, like a lot of it comes from the feeling of being loved and admiring the other person. And so a lot of it's opening your kind of mind to say like, is this person somebody that I really enjoy being around, and makes me feel really good? And so I think I can't really speak to the male brain, but I think for women it's much easier to do that conversion because, you know, I was already like, I wasn't not attracted to Phil. I just didn't have that like mind thing that said, oh, he's hot. And when I flip it on, I'm like, I really want to be around this guy.
And was the chemistry sort of transit like pretty, you know, instant, you know, first few weeks, months, it sort of, you know, made sense? Or was there really a build up time? Like,
yeah, it was weird at first, a little bit. Yeah. It was a little sister kissy. It's just hard like transitioning. It's like, yeah. Oh, we usually give each other like the friend hug, and now we're supposed to, like, you just have to like, yeah, really like changing the way that like you meet each other. It's like weird. Yeah. It flips all at once. And that period probably lasted for like 3 weeks, and then it was fine.
Yeah. And did you know early on, you're like, okay, this is my person. I'm gonna, or like, at what point did you know, like, okay, this is my person?
I think pretty early.
It was wild. It was so quick that we then, after we started being romantic, like they were like, this is it. This is totally it. I think within a year we started RGB.
You guys were like 30 at the time or how old?
Yeah.
30. Yeah.
Cool. You know, I've never seen you guys get in a big fight or like a nasty fight.
Should we do it here right now?
Exactly. Do you like, why is that? Do you guys have them, or what are your sort of thoughts on fighting?
No, we definitely fight. I think all couples fight. Maybe one little anecdote is we like, Kristen has this theory around fights that basically all fights basically sprout out from like a primordial, like fundamental fight, which is never resolved. There's just like the like core fight in your relationship that just has different forms. It's like a hydra with many heads. And so we give our fights names so we can like name them, like, oh, Fred's in the room now. Fred is like one of the fights that we just have over and over again in like different ways. And so for Fred is around basically interpretations of time and timeliness, like whether the 8 p.m. party actually starts at 8, whether maybe at 10 is the time it maybe starts. Is a classic. It's like, oh, Fred's here. Fred's present right now for us.
I think knowing that we kind of like that's our fight is actually like more grounding, because then we can be a more sane human, and we know that we're behaving in our roles, yeah, and when we're talking about something, and it actually pulls us out a little bit. So I think that actually realization was very important for our level of awareness when we were having any sort of disagreement. Yeah, the other thing I think with fights, and this is maybe unproven, but we do a lot of PDA. We'll be like, sometimes we'll sit away from each other at dinner. Actually, we do this also because it's just, you have stories to tell other people if you sit next to somebody else. But, you know, almost like we won't sit by each other because like I'll just be like just touching him, and it's awkward for others. But I think when you, especially when I touch him in different places, just kidding. but when you... when you do that, it's actually harder to be mad at somebody. And so I think our normative behavior is actually very affectionate. And I think that actually like makes kind of the first thing being intimacy and greeting each other. And it's lovely. I think it's just harder to fight when you're groping each other.
Yeah.
Insight one after the other.
Yeah. But is it fair to say you guys aren't really people who like will be like, oh, you know, Kristen and her Phil are so wrong, or kind of, you know, get in your head about it or dismiss, like, are you like, do you guys do that, or how do you sort of get back from that?
No, I think everyone's, we are those people. I don't know. I think we're just able to diffuse it in our heads eventually. The thing that happens is when like a kid shows up in your life, it's like, kids are nice palate cleansers. They're like, I'm mad at you because of this stupid thing. Oh, there's a baby. All of a sudden, it's okay.
I think also, I think we're like, I don't know if there's any tricks to just being maybe like self-aware and conscientious. It's like, I don't actually want to like make him mad. And so if I'm doing, I am going to approach him and apologize. Like my intent is not to hurt in the moment when we're angry or we're frustrated, it is, but not overall. And so I think we're like quick to actually just like rehash in a cold state, different things.
Yeah. But it seems that this broader idea I'm taking from you is this idea of like, people tend to either optimize for things that look good on paper or sort of the highest highs, but don't really think about the, you know, 1 million grocery runs or just sitting in traffic or, you know, having to deal with really annoying, boring, tedious stuff.
And actually, one thing that I see people try to do selection on, I think is actually people tend to be overweight, especially in the Bay Area. And we actually see this also with like housemate selection, is we've invited like over 100 people to live in our various communities. So now we have a pattern for like who makes a good person in your actual living environment. Is I think the intuition is that they like, I want to be with this person because they do really interesting stuff, or they are really interesting, or they have an interesting job, or they have interesting thoughts on X. And I think it turns out that actually what makes a great long-term partnership is not that you're interesting. It's that you're a good partner. And so like the best housemates, I think when we started doing this stuff, we would like try to pick the people who did the like, who had the most like interesting biographies almost. And that was our intuition on like who we wanted to live with. And it turns out the best people to live with are the people who are really committed to a good home life, because that's the way you're actually interact with them. And so it's like, yeah, so that's maybe one thing I would be like maybe downplay the like job resume, like, you know, extracurricular activity stuff a bit. Cause I think if that's interesting on day one, it's not gonna be as interesting on day 1,000. You're gonna get used to those things. But it's really like, are you gonna be a good partner to me in my home and in my daily life, which is most of the content of relationship.
How wise.
Thank you.
Talk about how you guys have thought about having children. You have a child. Your plan is so far has only been to have one child. Talk about how you've always approached having children and how that's evolved since you've had one.
Also, we know your bias here because you started a petition at our wedding to try to petition us to have more than one kid and got people to sign and do a chant at our ceremony. So thank you. It's at least for where you stand on this topic. But
I'm leading the witness.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll say I think we go into many things maybe over analyzing, and that's because we're just generally interested. So before, both of us were not like 100% we want to have a kid. We were also not like we don't want to have a kid. We were in the middle, like legitimately in the middle. It wasn't like I was hiding the fact that I did. And so our process actually was to gather information. And so we talked to a lot of people who had one kid, multiple kids. We talked to people, gay couples who had no kids, you know, childless families. And we basically just like learn together. So that was actually kind of another side project. We were learning together about what life could be like if we didn't have kids and life, what life would be like if we did have kids. And then from a decision standpoint, actually, I think this is.
And also parents love being interviewed about this. If you want to interview a parent about like, tell me about your decision to have kids and how you feel, they will.
Yeah. It turns out no parents, I think.
They will clear out their calendar to talk to you about that.
Yeah. Parents don't regret having kids. So they're like, I'll say it's hard. Yeah, it's part of a cult. We have to like understand that we're interviewing the cult.
Can we trust the cult leaders? The cult is good. I don't know if we can trust them.
Now we're part of the cult. and so, but I think a novel thing that we actually, this is a really stressful decision, right? It weighed pretty heavily on me, especially because I would have to make the decision like a year before Phil did with pregnancy and things. And so for these things, actually our hack is to put big decisions at a time and place. So we used to have something, we don't do it really anymore, but for the first 5 or 6 years of our relationship, we did like play dates where we would spend a weekend or a day fully devoted to kind of understanding and improving our relationship. Sometimes this meant like just having fun. We challenged a friend to like give us 5 activities to do during the day that we hadn't done before. We got a tattoo after that, for a real tattoo. and some of it is like separating time for big decisions. So where we said, you know, in this kind of box, in this container, we will try to like have a real discussion and a decision about, and we actually decided to get married in one of those. What that does is basically relieve the anxiety from a day to day. Like I'm not having to nag Phil like, well, what do you think? She's like, when should we
like talk? In passing between a meeting, so do you want to have kids? No, it's like, you don't have to do that because you know. You know you're going to talk about it at the play day in March when you've like made time for big discussions.
Yeah, and I think that's actually relieved a lot of stress from that period of our life because we really had like a place and time and a structure to make a decision versus like it never ending and like just having kind of it weigh on both of us that we had this looming thing going on.
And on the second kid, because I know Eric, your opinion on this, we've been interviewing people and the main question we've been asking couples that have more than one kid is if one kid is 1x work, how much work is two kids? And I want to know, is like two kids, is it linear? Is two kids 2x work? Is two kids more than 2x work? Are they multiplicatively like difficult? Or is it like less than 2x work? Are there like economies of kid scale? And what's crazy here is totally different answers from everyone. Like I would think like it's like even distribution between people saying two kids is more than 2x as hard as one kid and people saying it's less than 2x as hard as one kid. So we're unclear on what the signals are telling us on that one.
And so say more about the sort of skepticism of having multiple kids from the get-go. Is this idea of it's going to take over your lives, you know, trade off against careers, trade off against fun, against romance, or what was sort of the main hesitations?
All of the above. I think, you know, especially for a woman, and this is kind of like, in general, this is maybe a fact, but it is like, it's a lot of work to have a kid as a woman. And so even now with Ray, you know, I have my own company, I'm working less with our first child. And that is by choice. No one's asking me to work less. And I think I'm personally nervous about that decision is like with two kids, I would work even less. And again, no one would be forcing me. I'd want to work less. But is that the life I want to design? And I think that's a real good question to ask is like how, you know, what is that balance? And I'm fortunate, and I think Phil's too, to really enjoy our work too. We get a lot of impact and meaning from it. And so, you know, we would be giving some of that up.
And talk more about how you think about careers as a couple. You know, Kristen, you've been running a successful behavioral consultancy for a long time. And Phil, you've also had a successful tech career and have started a business called Live Near Friends, helping more people live near friends in the past year or so. So you're both running companies and you have a child. How do you make it work? And how do you think about just the idea of career as a couple?
I think it works because we live in this community, honestly. So I think there's two things that make it work for us. It's living in the community and this is a little like gauche to say, but I think I would want to hear this if I was before having a kid. It's like, I don't think that money buys happiness before you have a kid. Like, I don't think people with more money are actually much happier than people with less money, you know, above a certain minimum threshold. I think money does buy happiness after you have a kid, because money buys childcare and childcare is the thing that enables you to live the life you want to live with a kid. So I think it actually is helpful to have resource at like this stage of life and like that actually matters. And, you know, and the other thing is we see a lot of our friends, even ones that like, you know, do well for themselves financially, reluctant to outsource childcare. There's like something in their like culture and their upbringing that says like, you're a bad person if you're not the individual watching over your kid all the time. Where they think Chris and I just like don't have that. We want to see our kid exactly as much as we want to see our kid. And all the times we're happy to have someone else be with our kid. And it's allowed us to do that. So Kristen does this thing with all of her friends who live near us, which she has a standing nanny that comes both Saturday and Sunday for the first half of the day. And there's a sign up sheet and all our friends will just sign up to like slots for the nanny. And the nanny can either take two or three kids. And we sort of encourage our whole friend group to like have a nanny on the weekend, which is something that a lot of people are like, that seems crazy, but it allows us to, you know, have hobbies and not having to decide every single time you want to go on a run, whether you're going to hire a nanny, just knowing that every Saturday without talking to your partner, there is a nanny, I can go. I don't need to coordinate with anyone. I know I have that free time. It is I think a real, you know, life opener if you can afford it, you know, which I do recognize not everyone can. But I think we found that like, you know, we don't like fancy things or fancy apartments, but we've appreciated the return on lifestyle that paying for childcare brings.
I'd also add in this kind of like, how do you balance career? And I would say like just other, you know, Phil goes on these long climbing trips that I go on long, like kind of some like a work trip since our team's fully remote. And so I think we actually have a lot of like focus on the individual, whereas like, especially with one kid, it's like, I'm fine taking the kid for 3 or 4 days. Phil's fine taking the kid for 3 or 4 days.
We impose on each other a lot.
Yeah, we impose on each other a lot. And I think that idea of like giving the other person kind of full freedom to go and live their individual lives is very nice. And it has to be kind of like, I have to ask him to do it. He has to ask me to do it for it to work. If one person does it, it feels unfair. But if both of us do it, it's like a benefit.
It's like those poly relationships where only one person takes advantage of the poly are like doomed. And like you see a lot of those where like one person's more excited about it. I think if both partners impose on each other a lot with like, I'm going somewhere, you're watching the kid, and it happens a lot both ways, it's actually a very stable, very healthy thing. But if you're playing the game of like, I feel guilty leaving my partner with the kid, I'm not going to do this, I think that's actually like the road to unhappiness and a worse life. So I think impose on your partner. I think that's, you know, we're not super experienced parents. We have one kid, but I think that's one thing we like to tell our friends. Yeah. But we're,
Do you have a sense of like equality or divide and conquer, or just like, how do you think about that?
There's a lot of life tasks, and we kind of have maybe more than average because we've taken on this, you know, radish and these like life experiments. And so what does tend, and Phil's kind of better at this, of like 100% not keeping score, like people say this, and it's true. Like as soon as you start kind of being transactional about like, well, I did the laundry 4 times, and then it messes with your head. And so I think as a value, we really do kind of have this like core, just over deliver sort of thing that we're in it for, you know, we're doing the things and we're not actually transactional. I do think one realization for me with the kids stuff, which was helpful, was like, look, it's just actually harder on the woman. Like I can't blame Phil for that. That's not his fault. That's just how the world works. And I do think women can get in their heads a little bit because it's like so much harder for pregnancy in the first year of life that you can easily blame the other partner. And it's actually just like, that's just what I signed up for being a woman. Like, that's it.
Our mutual friend, I think, gave us this great piece of advice when Kristen was pregnant, which is like, he's like, no matter how hard Phil's going to try, it's only possible for him to do 30% of the work of having this kid, max. And so just, you have to accept that.
I was like, bummer.
And I thought that was good. It was, first of all, it let me off the hook. So I was very happy with that. But it was also great advice.
Low expectations is the key.
Yeah.
And it analogs, I think, a principle we have like in our living communities, which is like, you know, we sort of say like fairness is overrated. And I think getting really fixated on like everything being equal and what's fair is like a real road to unhappiness in any sort of organization or relationship. And so I think the like priority is make it good, don't make it fair. And it is never the case in any group or any relationship where it's 50-50 on work ever.
Yeah, and I do think we are privileged because we are both willing to and able to contribute. And so in relationship, I don't think this is advice we can formally give if the relationship effort is totally like women totally, should totally, have totally, conversations totally. If it's unfair, men should as well.
You gotta put in your 30%.
You got baseline.
Yeah. But like it doesn't have to be fair. It just doesn't. And like if you get over being fair and just focus on being good, you end up with better communities, better work environments, better relationships.
That seems like a fight that you don't have that other couples have. Is there anything else that comes to mind of a fight that you guys rarely have that other people don't have? And I'm curious also how you think about just like bouncing back from fights when you do have them. Are you guys good at just like letting things go, or just like, is there a ritual around for forgiveness? Do you believe in, you know, never go to bed angry, this kind of thing?
Are you asking if we have like makeup sex? Is that the question?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. We actually do have a thing that Phil's put on me, but I think this is like maybe normal, which is like, we can't talk about big issues after 9 p.m. He would probably prefer like 8 p.m. But like there's the level of, and that it took me a while to like get that I'm not going to be successful if I talk to him about something after 9 either. Like it's in my best interest if we wait. And so I think timing to talk about issues, I don't think we behave perfectly. I think we give each other grace. There's things where like I have a tone that he'll be like, can you fix your tone? And I realized, you know, I want to be persuasive. I should fix my tone. Like,
and the tone is shrill. It's lecturing. It's hectoring. It's
being right.
do you think
it sounds really hard to deal with?
But you should want to be happy.
It's my tone.
It's usually
you should want to be happy then, right? Do you believe that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think in general, it's like the way to persuade somebody isn't to have a tone. Like, that's just actually not a successful way to come to a shared agreement. And so I think in general, that's good advice he gives me real time. And also it's like advice that I've learned to take where we're actually, we do have a shared problem. We are trying to problem solve, especially with these big projects together. We have to problem solve a lot and trying to figure out kind of how we do this when we do disagree and it is more emotional has been something we work on.
Yeah.
He'll never has a tone. He actually doesn't. He's so good. No tone.
I just zone out and shut down. So yeah. That's my tone.
What did Dan Ariely, your co-founder and / mentor, what did he teach you about relationships or what did you learn from him?
It's a good question. I think so once he told me, I was single in my 30s or like late 20s. And I was like, Dan, what's wrong with me? He's like, you're more like something you have to like get to know to really appreciate. I was like, thanks. But it actually was maybe more true that like it was something where like I would do better with somebody who fully knows my personality and quirks. So that was nice advice that like sometimes people, it's very obvious their best qualities and maybe others it takes some time. I think the other thing is he's a big one for admiration too. Yeah. Like basically that you kind of deeply admire the other person.
I remember him telling me that when we started dating.
Yeah. So I brought Dan, I brought Phil. I was like, Dan's the best guy I know to like think about decision making. So like I'm early dating with this guy, but I'm gonna bring him to Dan. I've never introduced anyone to Dan before. This is like a dinner. I was like, Dan, tell me what you think after this dinner. I told Phil it's important. And the first question Dan asked when Phil sits down.
Literally sat down, like bread's not even on the table.
Formal dinner in Palo Alto, you know. Yeah. I was like, what are your intentions with Kristen? And he's like, isn't that what you wanted me to do? And I was like, I mean.
I thought he was just being jokey and sort of, and so I gave him sort of a flip answer. And it turns out he was serious.
Terrible answer.
He wanted to know what your intentions.
Yeah, but I do think that there's like this level of deep admiration that you have. And I mentioned this before, but like, just today I was asking Phil about work things that would help me. And he asked me like, our lives are pretty intermingled where we just really appreciate the other person's opinion. And so I think that's kind of where the core admiration comes from, where it's harder to like.
Kristen was dumping on the copy. I put it in a marketing email right before we got on this call. And she was right.
Was it right?
And she was right. Once again, she had the I'm right tone on and it was true.
But this time I just raised my eyebrows.
One of your philosophies of behavior change, Kristen, is that people don't change behavior. And so does that mean that one...
Well, unless you hire Irrational Labs.
Yeah, exactly.
It just costs money if you want to change.
Does that mean that you're often not trying to change each other's behaviors? And also that when people are together, they should just assume that, you know, what you have now is what you have for life. And that if you can't take it, then you should get out.
Yeah. So I think that there's a nuance to this. People don't change behavior. It's like the same person in the same context always will likely behave the same way. So the question is, can you change the context? Can you change the environment? So in behavior change research, we don't really try to change the person. We don't try to like increase their willpower or make them, you know, all of a sudden happier. We try to change their environment. So like very tactically for this like clothes on the floor thing, it's like, I'm not going to try to convince Phil to like all of a sudden start hanging up his clothes. I just put a laundry basket in our room. It was like, put the clothes in the same place, but aim for this basket. Now, all of a sudden, our room looks much better because the clothes are in the basket. And so I think this is though the essence, like the reason why we're at Radish too, is like we are designing our lives and like we as the same people doing the same thing would have less relationships, probably less happiness, less of a good relationship if we weren't at Radish. But instead we've designed our system, our environment to be, and it takes work. So I think that's the problem, is a lot of this life design takes work.
Yeah. I think we're like anti like grind set people, even though we do work hard. But I think the notion of the grind, like I'm just going to will my way through things and create my good life, we think is like fundamentally, you know, fundamentally sort of
misguided.
Misguided, thank you, is a word. And but people, I think, underutilize the design of their like immediate environment. And it's like, if you want to go to the gym, move next to the gym. Like, there's no amount of self-motivation that is going to overcome, that's going to be better than taking that one action and changing your environment in that way. And so I think people really need to think about like, what are the things within a 5-minute walk of where you live? Who are the people? What are the places? And that is one of the most important sort of locuses of control in your life.
One thing that you guys have talked about is extravagant friendship bids. What are those and why are they important?
Yeah, I think for us, friendship or people kind of is like a life design principle. Like, people is kind of a big value we share. And so we like to bring good people in. Friendship is hard, especially at the start and especially as you're an adult. So a lot
especially
of
in your 30s and 40s.
Yeah, it's just like it gets harder because people have their own lives. And so, and, you know, I think we do value newness and kind of like interestingness coming into our lives, which means we have to make some new friends in our 30s and our 40s and our 50s. So we've kind of gotten to the practice of extravagant friendship bids, which is like, for one, a shared couple that we know, we met them once and then we flew to Maine, was it?
Yeah, they made an offhand remark that like, we was like, oh yeah, we're going to Toronto for this thing. You guys are welcome to come. And it was totally just like a throwaway thing that people say. And we're like, we're coming, bought the tickets. and it's, yeah. And it's like, you know, it's a little ridiculous sometimes, but I think it like, I think it's like the way you get over the activation energy of friendship at a stage in life when people are like, maybe like a little more closed off and have like a little less energy for it, is you sort of got to like really, really leap into it in that sort of way. We're like that like meme of the like over excitable like girlfriend.
Yeah, but maybe it's like, but we're also hopefully they like it. So yeah, I would do this ask for it, not just fly to randomly your friends unless it's consent.
We're also like, we're like, come live at Radish for a month. Like we have a guest RV, just come live with us for a month. And people, they're not used to hearing that, right?
So I think that is one of the ways that we've kind of gotten a lot of, we have made bids. Like, we like, maybe make it clear when we like somebody, which is, I think, half the battle in kind of adult relationships. And I think that makes our lives more full when we have people, you know, we are who we surround ourselves with. And so when we meet people that we want to be around more, we actually go out, we make it a priority, like individually and as a couple, to kind of bring these people in. And I think that has kind of paid off to have like a good friend group and social circle.
I've stayed at your RV for a month, but I'm not sure if I was invited or if I just declared myself.
By the way, and the opposite also works. We make asks of our friends. And I think
that's
something where like Phil built a shed. And, you know, for me, I was like, why can't we just, the joke was like, buy a shed from Home Depot. But like, he built a shed and then invited people over to help build it. And by helping build the shed, people feel committed to us and to Radish. Yeah. And so making these kind of asks of friends.
We call it Tom Sawyer in your way through life. is like life value of it.
Yeah. The post having kids, do you have to schedule sex or what's that like?
I mean, I want to. I think we're like the classic.
Kristen sends me your Calendly and like I can usually find a spot in February.
I think that's maybe one of like our values is we try different things. So like we're like, we have tried scheduled sex. We have decided sometimes we do it, sometimes we don't. What? Oh. It's fine. He asked. He literally asked.
I'm very serious. He just got to respond maybe to his advice every time. He's good.
But
and then you add your admin in. to reschedule.
Yeah, to reschedule. Maybe rejected on calendar and I think what actually does is like, you know, when you're within probably couples experiences during COVID, but like when you're with each other all the time and you have a kid, you're with each other more, is like you do have to figure out ways to make things exciting. And so actually like for us, like travel or, you know, one of us going away is probably the biggest intervention because you're appreciating your life, you're appreciating the other person more when you return. And so I think that level of kind of like planned desire is nice.
Yeah.
Oh, here's another friendship hack that I think works well. I stole this from this guy, Weston. So this is thieved, but we call it amiguero, which is you decide you're gonna like dedicate a certain amount of time, let's say over a weekend, to just being a good friend to your friends. And that's what you're gonna do. And you offer up to your friends, like, I have a 3-hour time slot. It is yours for everyone to use it. You can use me to organize your closet with you. You can use me to like sit there and like job interview with you and like practice job interviews. You can like, you know, sit there and I will watch you while you write. However you want to use me, I'm yours for 3 hours. And that's actually like, first of all, it's a fun way to like interact
with
a friend.
Not sex, right? Not
but no, yeah.
As long as it's unscheduled.
You gotta schedule that out, as you know. Yeah. But it's a really great way to bond with a friend. And like people are not used to receiving offers like that. And I think they're not used to accepting offers like that. And I found this to be useful.
Yeah, he's a nice guy. He's a really nice guy.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
And you have to ask them later.
Yeah, I'm not sure how I would use it. I mean, it's such a golden opportunity. It's a pretty interesting one. You know, when your wedding was sort of themed as IPO and you had this prospectus or sort of this like vision document, is there anything else from that document or just like how you thought about the vision of your future that we haven't discussed that might be interesting?
Yeah, that's a good... I think we go about things... Infill's really good at this, but like from first principles. So it's like, how would we want to design a commitment ceremony with our good friends? And we had like a session where we asked about blind spots with people beforehand. We had this contract that actually made public, instead of just having, you know, a session where we commit to each other kind of at a surface level, and this I just called all weddings surface level. But we write a document, you know, that specifies like our specific details, kind of thoughts on our relationship that our friends could read and engage with.
And then propose amendments too.
And propose amendments too. But I think some of that's like a
where
first...
Where Eric proposed we have 7 kids.
Yeah. It's a first principles type thinking though that says like, hey, especially for these big decisions, and you don't get a lot of them in life, right? You know, it's like buying a home, having a kid, marriage, like think from kind of first principles and be okay to kind of change the script. And I think the script for us, I think we both have an aversion to the script that it's like given out.
This is sort of our fundamental hobby is trying to write our own script just because we like it and because we're sort of insufferable sometimes. But there's the meme I saw on Twitter today. It's like, you know, the one with like Winnie the Pooh and then Winnie the Pooh in the tuxedo, like two different things. And it's like the first one says common sense and the second one says first principles. And I'm like Silicon Valley, it's called common sense first principles.
Yeah.
How do you guys think about like depending on your part? It seems like you guys are pretty sort of emotionally stable people relative to the average person. But are there things that come to mind where you're like, oh, I'm tempted to go to the other person, but it feels like, you know, too much to put on someone. And so I should really just meet this need myself or via some other way. How do you think about sort of like the right balance between that?
I think especially when you like live alone with your partner, the... Like we all like, and you both work, you go through this hard work day of all these stressful things that happen in your job and your partner does too. And then your temptation is at the end of the day, you just want to be like, your partner just dealt with this whole day of work stress and they're like, okay, finally the work day is over. And then the other person comes in and is like, here's all my work stress too. And all of a sudden, I think that can be like a lot for like, you know, couples that both work. And so I think you need to like have people that can like absorb some of the things that you need other people to absorb who are not just your partner. And then this is Eli Finkel's the all or nothing marriage. It's like all or nothing marriages, I think, are a lot because you're handling all of your things and all of someone else's things. And so like spreading those around, I think, can be a benefit to your partner a bit.
Yeah, I would also say I think with this first principle thing, like I was going through a big decision. Probably now like 4 years ago. And you wrote me a, like, it was really always on my mind. It was like, I was probably insufferable on it. And you wrote me a letter and was like, look, I'm kind of mirroring what you're reflecting. And I think it caught my attention in a different way, to say like, hey, like I'm seeing this and, you know, here's kind of my point of view on it in a more formal way. Which I really appreciated. And I think in general, the partner is actually a good catch to say, like, is this a normal spinning or a normal rumination versus something that, you know, may actually be something that you should talk to somebody or get help. And I don't think we've had many of those experiences, but we're not definitely not shy to share with people, but because we have all these other folks in high proximity, it's not an overly dependent thing.
Yeah, that's interesting. Looking at time here for a second, is there anything we haven't discussed that comes to mind that we should leave our listeners with? No worries if not. Do you think we talked enough about sex?
Yeah.
I feel pretty complete.
Yeah.
That's like yours.
Yeah, one thing.
You in each other's businesses, does that mean like is there more there or not really?
Not really, just that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel complete?
Yeah, no, I feel great. And you guys have been a couple I admire and look up to for a long time. So I appreciate you guys setting the example and coming and sharing your learnings and lessons with us.
Where do we rank, would you say, amongst the couples?
Well, you're definitely in the top two so far.
Oh, wait, just the other couple you interviewed. I am not overall of all the couples you know.
I think you're a top couple for sure. Okay. Top three.
Okay. We have two people to knock off.
Give us the names and we'll get to work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. For people who want to get Cal invites, they should just reach out to you and,
Yeah, we'd love to hear. I mean, I think actually for folks who are doing interesting life design things, reach out. I think both of us have actually built our professional and our personal lives around kind of changing the environment so that we are happier, but also we help other people be happier. So I think that is actually an interest.
And just to clarify, you guys view career as like a thing that you enjoy and a way to make money, but is not like the main priority in your lives? Or how would you sort of think, characterize how you think about careers in the relative to perhaps how some peers or people in San Francisco think about couples, you know?
I think our hobbies and our careers and our like life performance over life are just very intertwined.
It's almost
and
the sort same
of inseparable.
Thing.
Yeah. It's like there's just like different incarnations of I think like the same like truth that we're interested in, and like you know we have the constraint of needing to make money, and so like some piece of that needs to be a thing that does that. But I think we'd be doing some version of this for free if we didn't need money. Yeah,
and I think that's a very privileged thing to say. Like, so Irrational Labs is a very much an identity for me. Like, I deeply believe in the theories of behavior change that we're coaching and consulting and designing and doing research with companies. And so I think I think we are focused on work a lot. I would say like our head's always in the game for work. And we're very lucky that we then share kind of this like in our personal lives, we get to explore the same type of passion that we do at work.
Yeah. And, one game that you've suggested playing, Kristen, is where everyone just shares their body count and net worth. And that's because you want people to open up and you just like fucking with people or?
Both. One, I think to go from first principles here, most conversation tends to be either a conversation you've already had with people or something that's maybe just not that interesting. And I think it's really hard for an individual to change. So like walking into a party and asking somebody like, what's your deepest fear is inappropriate. And I don't recommend people do this, but having the agreed social norm that actually talking about more interesting things is then okay. And it becomes weird if you talk about kind of sports teams or whatnot. And so the whole goal is to kind of like create a shared social norm around talking about things that we don't normally talk about. Yeah.
What's the thing you did at one of Eric's events where people have the name two or three things?
That's what he's talking
about.
It was
you got it your net worth, your body count.
I was getting there. Yeah.
What was the third one?
GPA is our like SAT score.
Yeah.
And it turns out that actually people are more nervous about the net worth thing. They don't like talking about this. And I think it's okay actually to say not to. And for the people who did, it's actually it's like a very memorable event. Like that could have been something like, we don't remember most things. Most things we just like, if you were to ask me what I did yesterday, it'd be really hard actually for me to pick out like, what did I do yesterday? And so I think in conversation, in these moments with friends, you can really create memorable things when you talk about taboo topics, like money and sex and all these things. And so if you want to have a memorable night, just ask somebody their net worth.
You sell conversation cards with this sort of stuff. Yeah,
I do. They're all sold out, though.
They're all sold out, yeah.
Just in time for Christmas.
No, totally. Speaking to the memory part, once I heard how many partners you guys have had, I've never forgotten that. It's just
sure.
Blown away. There's one last thing I wanted to. So baby number two. When are you gonna make? What's gonna push you over the edge? Either way.
This
probably
podcast,
continual pressure from you is gonna do that.
Yeah.
Public, if you want to wait,
if you want to flip a coin, we can leave that as a cliffhanger, and just like you can cut the podcast there as it's like spinning. Like sort of like Inception.
Yeah, exactly. It's so good. Okay. Until next time.
I think a decision point, though. I think actually how we make these things is just having a kind of a structure for a decision. So we're kind of going from first principles there and thinking it.
Awesome. Chris and Phil, thanks for coming on.
First principles.
should we name the, if we do have a second shot, maybe we name it first principles.
Second principles.
Second principles.
Yeah, exactly. All right. See you guys.
Hey, Eric.
Thanks for listening to Modern Relationships. Please make sure you're following on Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. If you have a chance, leave us a review or comment on this episode to let me know who else you'd like to hear from on this show. Modern Relationships is a podcast from Turpentine, the network behind Econ 102, Upstream, and Turpentine VC.